Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Only banks should create credit and create it at interest. The governments should not provide money to the economy. Government should raise their money by selling off their public domain to private investors. The governments should not provide social services, should not provide infrastructure services. That all of these should be privatized, and that means building into their price structure interest charges, exorbitant salaries, and economic rent for whatever the privatizers can charge.
This is an economic system that is unacceptable because it doesn't work very well, and we could do better.
But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything.
And on that cheery note, let me wish you a happy new year. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute and co-host of this program, It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. What we just played for you were excerpts of some of the guests and program topics we covered in 2015, beginning with noted economist Michael Hudson, followed by another noted economist, Dr. Rick Wolf, and then the inimitable George Carlin. If you're looking for a thread through those comments, I guess it would have to be that when you pull back the curtain that hides our world's monetary regime, you find a system that's simply not designed to serve people. That the game, as Senator Elizabeth Warren says, is rigged. On today's program, we're going to be taking a look back at a few of the stories that made 2015 an important one in the struggling world of economic democracy and fairness. Ellen will be along in a minute with some words about her newest article on bail-ins, and she talks later with one of our kindred colleagues in Germany from the Sparkassen Savings Bank, which, after 200 years of no bank failures, is now having to struggle with the global banking interests. Later, Ellen, Matt Stannard, and I talk about our top picks of the economic stories of 2015. But now, let's speak with Ellen about the possibility of an impending theft of your money by a bank near you.
So the bail-in is starting to happen. We've had some real skepticism on the part of people that this could absolutely ever happen. What do you mean they can take our money? Well, that's a point of law well established. What are you observing with your analysis of it?
Well, it's actually happening now in Europe. Just recently, like at the end of November, there was an Italian bank that went bankrupt. It was a local bank. It wasn't one of your too-big-to-fail banks, but it went bankrupt, and now they all apparently have to go under this orderly resolution plan. The idea of an orderly resolution is to prevent a disorderly resolution, which means something like what happened in 2008, where what they're worried about is this whole domino effect of the derivative scheme collapsing. So it's all about propping up the derivatives, and it's done at the expense of the investors and the depositors. And so this bank in Italy was insolvent, and so they turned to the new resolution plan. But first, before they could get money from that fund, they had to bail in their creditors, which included that one man. I mean, the reason it made the news was one man committed suicide because he lost his whole 100,000 euro investment. And the reason the president did it now, or the prime minister, was that if they waited until January, they're going to actually be bailing in the depositors' money as well. So even more people would be hurt. But as it was, there were like 130,000 people who were hit by this bail-in. And earlier in July, there was the bail-in of a credit union, and the credit union had its own insurance fund. And after they bailed in the investors' money, which who happened to also be credit union members because that's the way the whole thing is set up, then they bailed out. They repaid those people through their credit union deposit fund.
But which is a good thing, right?
It sounded like a good thing. But it seems it was not a good thing in the sense that this was frowned on because it would defeat the purpose of the bail-in scheme. In other words, if you're going to allow people to flee to the credit unions who have their own insurance scheme, then you're not going to be able to hold people in the banks who you want to be able to bail in their money to prop up the big banks who are vulnerable to a derivatives collapse.
Wow.
And then we have the same thing here, the same. It's all on the books. It's in the Dodd-Frank Act. And before that, it was in the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, which said that derivatives are basically exempt from bankruptcy, that they go first. So they all get to grab their collateral, and if there's anything left, then everybody else stands in line over the scraps. There may not be any scraps.
How could there be any scraps? It's a $10 trillion category for Citibank, isn't it?
Well, that was for all the, there was 5% of derivatives that had to be off the books that couldn't be counted. You know, if you went bankrupt, they weren't counted in a bail-in. But because those were the 5% where the bank was gambling for its own account, not supposedly helping out some client. But that 5% is the big, you know, the very vulnerable 5% because they're doing really risky stuff there.
Right.
And Citibank is particularly vulnerable because of the oil collapse, which actually happened a year ago in the fall, and so it was in December that they made this change through the Cromnibus spending bill.
And this was the cause for Elizabeth Warren's outspoken shout-down of the...
Yeah, and it was good she did, or nobody would have even known about it. That's the thing. It was a huge bill.
Right.
And
so next year is going to be pivotal in so many ways. Yeah. Now, tell me about Ireland for a minute, because there's talk of creating public banks there on a regional bank basis, right?
Mm-hmm. So it'd be more like the Sparkheiser model where
right.
you have all your little local public banks. It's not one big public bank like the Bank of North Dakota, which then services private banks. These are a network of public banks that support each other.
And you talked with Wolfram Morales of Sparkhausen. It sounds like they've got a bit of a growth industry, perhaps. They're going all over the world to try to secure and educate people about this alternative sort of banking and how successful it's been, and you know, come check it out.
Their motive, they're not trying to expand. They're not allowed to expand there, but they have to be restricted to their own community, which is one reason that they're so successful. They don't get into risky global things.
Right.
But their motive is that they are under attack, just like the credit unions are. They have their own insurance scheme, but they're being hamstrung with all these regulations that make their very profitable system less profitable. Last January, the Bundesbank came out with figures that showed that the Sparkhausen were actually more profitable than the private sector banks,
right.
and they paid more in the way of taxes. So they did a lot more for the community. And, you know, a year ago last November, the Wall Street Journal reported the same thing about the Bank of North Dakota, that it was actually more profitable than Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan.
Yeah. So naturally, we would expect that the big banks are going to be quite upset with the appearance of some public banks almost anywhere in the world. Well, Ellen, thanks for that, and look forward to your conversation with Wolfram. We'll catch up to you in a moment.
Okay. My guest today is Wolfram Morales, manager of the Office of the Executive President of the East German Savings Bank Association. The German savings banks, or Sparkhausen, are banks held by the public sector at various levels, local, regional, and federal. They manage 40% of the banking assets of Germany, so that's nearly half the banking sector. The Sparkhausen Group, therefore, has a lot to teach us about public banking. It's great to be speaking with you, Wolfram.
Well, great to speak with you, Ellen. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks. We're going to be on a panel together on public banking in Iceland in February, so I'm totally looking forward to that.
Yes, I'm too. It's very exciting. My first time to have a panel in Iceland.
I think they have great potential in Iceland because they're so free-thinking and independent, and
yes,
it's just like a little experimental place. Well, I wondered if you could tell us a bit about the history of public savings banks in Germany and how they came to be so... I guess they dominate the domestic banking market. Is it like 80% if you include the credit unions?
Yes. At the time, we serve around 50 million people, and you have to know that Germany has a number of inhabitants of 80 million, so it is a large number. But telling something about the history in a short way, German savings banks, or Sparkassen as we say, were established over 200 years ago by concerned citizens and local governments. It was a time of change in Germany. 200 years ago, we were in the situation to change from an agrarian society to an industrialized society. And we have some collateral damage in this process, huge unemployment, huge numbers of poor people and so on, and a lot of social problems and no social network compared to the situation in the United States today, Germany in that time, or the United States today compared with the situation of Germany in that time. You have to say that the United States today are a full socialist country, only to compare the difference of the situation from in that time in Germany. And so these people came to the idea to create some public banks as parts of the city halls or parts of the administration of a county. Interestingly, they follow an idea of an Englishman, and this Englishman was Daniel Defoe. I think you know Daniel Defoe. This was the author of Robinson Crusoe.
Right.
And Daniel Defoe gave the idea or developed the idea that to battle against poverty, it is necessary or it is a good idea to create a kind of offices in each county and give the people, especially the poor people, the chance to put money safely in that office. And this was the idea because we create Sparkassen around 200 years ago. And later, in the first years of the 20th century, we had the idea that it is not only a good thing to give the people the chance to put money, to have money safe in an office, but it is a good idea to have an institution that helps to develop the regional economy. And so it was allowed to the Sparkassen to give loans to small enterprises. And this is the secret of the German success in the 20th century. Up today, we have the same that in all over the country, you can find round the corner a Sparkasse, and this makes it very easy for small businesses to get loans and to rise the business. And the same for the common people. You find the Sparkassen, as I say, around the corner, and we are serving the needs of the people, and we have the directors even around the corner, and not in 2 or 3 hours by plane, like the big banks. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, this is one of the big advantages of the Sparkassen and one of the secrets of the development that brings us to have 50 million from 80 million as clients.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very interesting. So it started as a safe place to put your money, and then it grew from there to be a place to lend to local businesses, correct? What about, do you make homeowner loans as well, or is it business loans?
The Sparkassen today, since around 50 years, Sparkassens are full banks, that mean universal banks, that is the right denomination. All kinds of businesses, from savings to loans to homeowner loans, and even some products of assurances.
We have one publicly owned depository bank, that's the Bank of North Dakota, a state-owned bank. We also have things like state infrastructure banks, but that's the only one that is close to your model. But then it's just one for the state, and it partners with the local banks, which are privately owned. But there was a study that came out a year ago. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs. And I saw that last January there was also a German study that found that the Sparkassen were more profitable than the private German banks. So I assume that includes Deutsche Bank, which is the one we've all heard about. So how do you explain that, you know, if the whole point is not even to make profit but just to serve the public, how is it that your public banks and our one public bank are so profitable?
Yes, this is completely right. It is exactly what my figures say, or the figures of our central bank, the Bundesbank. And it is the same since a lot of decades. In my opinion, it is because we don't make some high-risky business. In a first point, we don't make high-risky business. Secondly, it is a wrong idea to think that you cannot make profits with common people. We serve the people here in Germany, and the business with the people, these are not very complicated businesses. This is, as I say, they put some product or they buy some products to save money and so, and we give them some loans. And this is enough to be profitable and to be more profitable than making the big casino game at Wall Street. This is our experience, at least here in Germany. And we see that in all countries where you have a kind of public banks, it is the same. So this is my explanation, because we are making, as we say, the grandma's business in banking. What we are doing is not very sexy in banking or so. These are not business in high new products or so. Instruments, financial instruments. So what we are doing is grandma's business, and grandma's business is very profitable. But, of course, you have to have a connection between all those banks in a big network so that you can play economics of scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, the big public German banks that we have heard of, most people I don't think have heard of the Sparkassen, but the ones that made the news were the Landesbank and the big ones, right, that did get into trouble and that were gambling in derivatives. So what's your relationship to those banks, and why did they get in trouble?
These banks are daughters of the Sparkassen. These Landesbanken are, the best way to explain Landesbanken is to say Landesbanken are the central banks of the Sparkassen. Mm-hmm. And they are working like, in one part at least, they are working like central banks of the Sparkassen. On the other hand, the Landesbanken around 10-15 years ago had the situation to have such an excess of liquidity that they have to look how to put the liquidity. And they go into the same direction like the big mega banks, and began to play in Wall Street and with all that new financial instruments and betting and so on. And so they lose a lot of money in the crisis, like other banks. You have to know that not only the Landesbanken here in Germany had problems in the crisis, also the private-owned banks, not the Deutsche Bank in the first line, but if you see to the news in that time, you will find mm-hmm. that Deutsche Bank gets some support too before they had problems, for example, from the government of the United States, some billions and so. But it is true, the German Landesbank and our central banks in the public sector have these problems, and the reason was because they began to play the big casino game.
And our local banks are complaining about the new regulations, which are putting them out of, you know, they're just squeezing them to the point where they can't meet all these demands, and so they have to sell out to the big banks, which you could make an argument that was the whole point of these regulations. And I guess you have the same problem. In fact, that's one reason that you're out there trying to educate people about the Sparkasm model. But so what are you doing about the regulations, and are they, I mean, the EU regulations, I guess, are pretty onerous too, right? And are they hitting the Landesbanken and the Sparkassen the same, or do you manage to get out of it because you're little banks? Or?
Yes, these new regulations are hitting especially the Sparkassen, and like the community banks in the United States, as you explain. In first line, because the European Commission don't distinguish between mega banks and Sparkassen. They are making a policy following the idea that one size fits all, and that is simply not true. Mm-hmm. But you can protest against that. Finally, you have to serve the new laws and the new regulations, and that means we have higher costs. Maybe that some of the little Sparkassen have to join together to build a bigger one, but this is not a central point. Maybe that happens in the next year in one, two, or three cases, but this is not a big point. What we are doing is another time to go to our network. We are in. To tell you two figures, we are 417 savings banks, Sparkassen, and around 200 more in enterprises. One of them, of these enterprises, is a specialist for regulation. And what we are doing is putting more manpower in this one specialist, and this one specialist is serving the Sparkassen to fit and to develop to be fit to these new regulations. And we are educating the people into the Sparkassen to respond to the new needs following those regulations. But finally, it is a big problem not to put it in practice, but a big problem because you have to finance this new regulation needs. And even to calculate the numbers that you have to deliver to the central bank supervisory committee, for example, is a question of high costs. And mm-hmm. But we are, I think we will fit this. This is not a funny business, but we have to do it, and we will have some problems to fit this, but we will survive even these new regulations. You cannot make a one-size-fits-all policy, but this is another discussion.
Mm-hmm. So you have one agency or whatever, like enterprise,
yes,
as you said, that does the regulations for all the Sparkassen, so they don't have to do, you know,
no,
deals with
no,
the paperwork?
They have. They help them because most part of the regulations is think of electronics. You put all what you have to report into some programs, and then each Sparkasse can use this program and report to the bank. And what mm-hmm. we need is a central entity that develops all these programs and that is up to date with the new regulations. To give mm-hmm. you a figure, we need in our central institution for software or computing center, we need around 60 million euro every year only to fit the new regulations.
This is
completely crazy because mm-hmm. these are 60 million that we cannot use for other purposes. For example, In our business area, East German business area, there are four German states, and 60 million is exactly what we are giving for sports, culture, education, and so on.
Wow. Yeah, that's terrible. So you can make a case. I mean, I tend to be of the suspicious suspicious bent that that it's intended to squeeze out the public banks and to force, I mean, to make the international banking private network stronger and get do away with the public network. What do you? I mean, is that your sense? Is that part of your motive? And I know you're putting a lot of effort into this sort of worldwide educational campaign on the Sparkassen model and why that's so good. So, what do you hope to gain by that? And do you think? What do you think?
Yeah. As you say, our aim is not to make business, because it is forbidden to us to make business outside, even outside of the certain county that is the business area of the Sparkasse. But there are some motivations to make. The first is because, in our opinion, we have some good experiences of how to serve the people and how to serve the small and medium enterprises at a regional level. And this is needed especially in some developing countries, because they have the problem of development of small and medium enterprises. The second is that we were battled by some big entities like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank and some institutions, more the European Commission and so on, because we don't fit the ideology that private is good and public is bad. We are exactly the contrary, and we are showing, as you have the experience with the Bank of North Dakota, that a public bank can work very well and be very profitable. And so there is some fight of ideologies, if I can say it so. This way we are, or this is the cause, because we are showing worldwide how our model is working and helping some people to establish some ideas that we are working here for 200 years or so. And it is also a question of exchange of experiences with some other banks in the business of how to deal with regulation, for example, because not only are going into another countries to show the people what we are doing, we are going in the other countries to learn how they are working with regulations and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to be able to invite you here in California, where we're working on a public state-owned public bank, or possibly city-owned public. There are several city projects for city-owned public banks, so it'd be great to be able to share your experience. Your model isn't exactly the same as ours, but yours is very, very efficient. You've got 200 years of experience there to share, so that's cool. And I particularly like, it's not just the profitability, but the fact that it's safer for the depositors, because right now I've just now been writing about the fact that in Italy they've just started the bail-ins, where they're actually taking, they took the creditors' money, but apparently in January they will start taking the depositors' money as well across the EU. Is that something that the Sparkassen would be subject to as well, or are you sort of feeling?
This is a big problem of misunderstanding of the Sparkassen model by the European Commission and the European Central Bank. First, I have to say, yes, of course, we have to fulfill and to follow and to put in practice the same laws, because we have only a single law for banks in the European Union and in Germany. But it is completely crazy, because we have a joint liability scheme. That means that one Sparkassen or the Sparkassen as a whole helps in every case if one Sparkassen has a problem. So that we avoid that Sparkassen has to go bankruptcy. You cannot find any case in 200 years that a Sparkassen go bankrupt.
Wow, that's great.
And in addition to this, we are now forced to build up a second scheme or a second fund like what you have in the United States with the FDIC. This is the same model. The European model is a copy, 90% copy of the FDIC. But this model of the FDIC, what is maybe right for the United States, for Sparkassen in Germany, is completely wrong because we have a system that makes it sure that no participant in this system can go bankrupt. And if you cannot go bankrupt, you never have the problem to refund the customers because a bank that don't go bankrupt have not the necessity to pay back some deposits, loose deposits or so. But we have to finance a separate fund only to fulfill the law, the European law, and we are sure that we never will get any penny from this fund because simply it is not necessary because our system is working in another way. It is a second example of that we can have to waste money, more not.
Mm-hmm. Or an example that they're actually trying to defeat the public banking model.
at least it is an example of misunderstanding how we are working.
Mm-hmm. I saw something similar. I think it was Spain, I might be wrong, where the credit unions were complaining that they also are having to do this and they also have their own fund or their own way of preventing
bankruptcy. Even in Austria, the Austrian model is not the same. They have some, they call it Sparkassen because it is the same language. They are speaking German. They call it Sparkassen, and some time ago, this banks were 100% Sparkassen, but after some changes, this is not the same like in Germany, but they have such fund too, or several funds, and they have the same problem, yes.
Well, it's been great speaking with you. Do you have any other points you'd like to make for us in the U.S., things we should know?
No, at the moment, no, not, but I have to say I'm watching with big interest your work in the Public Banking Institute and around the United States. It is very interesting to see that there are some people working to develop some alternative models to the model that leads us to the big financial crisis.
Well, thank you, and you've been a great inspiration to us.
Thank you.
So anyway, it's been great talking to you, and I'm really looking forward to being on a panel with you in Iceland.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. I've been speaking with Wolfram Morales, manager of the Office of the Executive President of the East German Savings Bank Association.
Since this is our last program for 2015, the It's Our Money team thought that we would do a little retrospective on some of the financial and economic stories that made 2015 of particular interest. Joining Ellen and me will be Matt Stannard, who does our public banking report and is also the Public Banking Institute's media coordinator. We drew straws, and guess who won?
Well, okay, so internationally in Greece, in January, the Syriza party was elected against the advice and actually the pressure of Goldman Sachs and the Troika. So they were the anti-austerity party, and the threat was that if they were elected, if pro-austerity candidate weren't elected as prime minister, that ECB could possibly cut off funding for the banks. And sure enough, in June or July, when there was a referendum, a national referendum, and the people voted to go anti-austerity in order to support Tsipras, the prime minister who was elected head of the Syriza party, to support him in anti-austerity measures, then the credit was cut off by the ECB, and the banks had to close their doors, and there were runs on the banks, etc. So it was great turmoil, and Tsipras was finally cowed into submission, and so they got back with the program. Varoufakis, the economic advisor, quit. So that was the news on Greece.
You know, I think it wouldn't hurt for us to chat a little bit about that, because I think there, you know, implications in how it played out are also interesting. What you saw with the Syriza development and with the behavior of Tsipras was this clear demonstration of who's really running the show. And we did a variety of programs on Greece. One was called Greasy Mess with Paul Craig Roberts. We did one called We're All Greeks Now with Stephen Lenman, really sharing the pain that was over there. And I think there was generally an increase in awareness and of how the big banks were playing hardball with everyone, and democracy be damned. Ellen, in your assessment now, several months later, how do you think things are there, and what are they putting up with? What has been instituted? Is there any salvation at all for the Greek monetary system, or are they just stuck on an island?
Well, there is a whole movement to go progressive, and I saw that just in the last couple of days in Spain, the Podemos party got 20% of the vote, and so they actually will have a seat at the table, and Tsipras tweeted that this showed progressive movement and a movement toward anti-austerity and so forth, and they're moving that way as well. And I mean, there's still protests in Greece and so forth. So I think people are definitely fed up with things the way they are. But then what I'm just now writing about is the fact that bail-ins have started, and there may be no getting out of this. I mean, they're trying to kill the credit unions or try to thwart their ability to give you an alternative to these bail-ins. And in the U.S., we see that they've made the regulations so onerous that the community banks are struggling, and they're having to sell out to the big banks. And right. this is another point that I was going to raise of my three. But last December, as part of the Cromnibus spending bill, Citibank coerced this addition to the bill that basically made all their derivatives bets, I mean, the derivatives bets in general, but Citibank is particularly vulnerable because of oil. They have a lot of oil swaps, and oil has dropped like $40 in the last year, the price of oil. So when their swaps come due, which I think is supposed to be in the spring, then they could be in big trouble. So they're putting all these things in place so that we, the people, have no alternative but to have our money in a bank. And then when the banks go down, they can take our money legally to recapitalize themselves under this bail-in scheme. It's getting harder and harder to withdraw your cash. You can only withdraw a few thousand dollars at a time. So if you have like $100,000, which, I mean, I don't, but let's say somebody did in the bank, as there was a man in Italy that just was one of the early bail-ins, and he had 100,000 euros invested in bank bonds issued by the bank, and he committed suicide over that, because that was his whole savings. This was his bank. He'd banked up for 50 years. He trusted the bank. So his suicide note blamed the bank, but in fact, it's this whole bail-in scheme being imposed by the Financial Stability Board, which is part of the G20, of which we are also a part, and we also agreed to that, and it's also built into the Dodd-Frank Act. Anyway,
they're closing the window. You know, any chance to get out, we are really are trapped, and there are a number of technical ways that's happening politically, of course, everywhere. Matt, do you have any comments about the Greek development? Does it represent anything of a trend that you are seeing as well, or that you're concerned about this year?
I sure do, and I think it represents several things. The impending nature of the bail-ins is certainly one of them, and could end up being one of the top stories of 2016 if developments continue the way that we seem to think that they are. The other thing that strikes me, of all of the different parts of the Greek drama, the Greek tragedy, if you will, I think that the role of Germany is especially interesting to me as someone who follows not only the events in Greece, but also follows public banking. Everyone who follows public banking knows that Germany has some really robust public banks. They have several levels of public banking, and those public banks have been instrumental in almost everything that's good about the German economy. However, Germany has been particularly responsible for tightening the screws on Greece, and has been very intransigent about cooperating with Greece. And a lot of people have talked about the hypocrisy of Germany refusing to support bailouts on Greece because Germany itself has been bailed out historically. And so a lot of people have talked about that. But what one of the things that, only I think PBI has been talking about, because you can find it on our blog, is the irony of the German of one of the German public banks called the L Bank suing the European Central Bank to avoid coming under the same set of EU supervision and regulations as comparable banks that size.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Well, but that's the whole sarcasm public banking movement. Isn't the L Bank a Landis Bank, which is public?
It is the Landis Credit Bank, but they are suing the European Central Bank because there is a set of regulations the European Central Bank is putting forward that would apply to the L Bank. And I just, to me, the irony of that is the reason the L Bank wants to be exempt, the reason the L Bank doesn't want to fall under the, you know, the ECB umbrella here is that there are unique things that the L Bank does that they would be very much harder for them to do. Clearly, there are reasons why the European Central Bank is not a, good force in terms of promoting the public good. Germany is fine watching the ECB crush Greece, and the L Bank is not so fine in being crushed itself by the ECB.
You can't necessarily call them all the Germans either. I mean, just like you have Republicans and Democrats here that are totally going to disagree. But I think that the whole Sparkassen group and the Landis Banking group have their own insurance scheme, and so that's the problem, that now they have to pay double. They have to. They do not go bankrupt. They have never gone bankrupt. And the reason is that they always, when one goes insolvent, then they fund it through this insurance scheme that they all contribute to. And I saw that there was an Italian bank that went bankrupt, and it was a credit union, and they also have their own insurance scheme. So this is in July, so I think it was considered the first of the bail-ins. And they were forced into this bail-in program where the creditors had to bear the cost. And then the creditors, who were also members of the credit union, because that's the way they were set up, were then bailed out by their insurance scheme. And this was frowned upon because it was a way of getting around the bail-in scheme.
In other words,
the point of the bail-in scheme is to impose the costs on us, we the little people. They do not want a way to get out of it. They don't want somewhere that people can flee to and escape the banks that are subject to this bail-in mandate.
And what that represents is the taking of our money by design, setting up a situation where we are absolutely doomed to lose, cannot play with these people nicely. And Matt, I think, you know, your reference to the German government, I suppose what we're seeing here is what we talked about many times on the show during the year, and that was the unanimity of government and big banks, that the global banking cartel is really, really running the show, and that politically there's very little room for people to impact what's going on. And it's been rather stunning, frankly, to be a student of this year, to see it. I remember we did a number of shows. One was called Mad as Hell, which was George Carlin talking about how it's all a big club and we're not in it. Also, of course, the Mad as Hell show that we did, referring to movie Network, where he tells everybody to go to the window. I'm sick and tired. I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, we have, I think, this past year seen a colossal collapse in a lot of different areas of the notions that we've had, that there's some fairness, or if we had any more notions, there was some fairness in our financial systems, and now it's just starting to rush out of our hands. And I think one of the things that is accelerating that and will accelerate it further, in addition to the bail-ins you were talking about, is the removal of cash from the monetary system. That taking money out of the hands of people, not accepting payments in cash, having all of our accounts online in some digital form, leaves the people who have access to the switches in complete control. And so we did a program not too long ago called Mattress Futures. Get some money safer in the mattress. And frankly, I think that might be the smart money.
Yeah, if you can get it out, that's the thing. They're not even letting you pull out your the man with the 100,000 euros invested in bonds apparently couldn't get his money out.
I think, Matt, you wanted to speak to this too, about impact of not having money on the poor. We had a couple of instances here where the banks in our cities were playing hardball, and Matt, you wanted to talk about them.
I wanted to talk specifically, I mean, there's so much in what you said, and I want to add to half of Americans right now are economically insecure to the point at which a $400 to $1,000 emergency they couldn't handle.
Wow.
So that is, you know, that's data that's just come out this year, you know, that about roughly 50% of Americans could not front the cash to, if they had a serious, something serious going on with their car. Different things like that, they would have to borrow money, probably from a payday lender. But what Walt mentioned was, in particular, the study that just came out by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. The name of that study is Home Mortgage and Small Business Lending in Baltimore and Surrounding Areas. And what the study concluded was that in Baltimore City, race matters most in lending, even more than income level. That in within Baltimore, because the study compared in Baltimore and outside of Baltimore, but in Baltimore, the banks lend almost three times as much to whites as blacks, or three times as many whites as blacks residents in Baltimore, very much out of proportion to population, and even out of proportion to income level. And because of this, of course, and you see this in other cities as well, are really suffering a lot. Because of the unwillingness of banks and banks kind of finding ways to get around the restrictions on redlining. Because of this, you have serious underdevelopment. This is a similar thing is going on in Detroit, where they're manipulating some of the lending laws to really find new ways to redline the residents. And I guess my takeaway from these types of stories, and this is a huge story because there is a study and they now have evidence, I think my takeaway is that regardless of what factors go into the decisions of these private banks to do what they're doing, public mortgage lending banks would solve a lot of these problems because of the added layer of public transparency and the elimination of the shareholder profit motive. There would be, you'd have a much better chance at mortgage fairness and other lending fairness under a public banking system. Because we really can't rely on the good graces of these private banks if their motive is not the public good. If the public good is not their chief motive, then even trying to regulate out that racism and regulate out those other discriminatory practices, you're just going to be playing cat and mouse with them.
Yeah.
And the Fair Housing folks for a generation fought redlining and fought it successfully, but then the banks find other ways to do it. And that's what this very important study that I urge our listeners to Google. Again, it's National Community Reinvestment Coalition, and the study is called Home Mortgage and Small Business Lending in Baltimore and Surrounding Areas. And I suspect that it is not going to be the last that we hear from the National Community Reinvestment Coalition in terms of their studies of these practices around the country.
If we're looking for good news out of all this, out of all this darkness, I mean, the good thing is when people get seriously fed up, like I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, then things start to change. And so we are seeing signs of that. For example, in England, Jeremy Corbyn was elected against 100-1 odds, I guess. He said if you were a betting man, you could have made a lot of money on betting on him. He's head of the Labour Party, not because the other Labour MPs would have voted for him, but they put the election open to all the members, and the people wanted him because. And so the thing that I particularly like about his platform is that he was pushing for QE for the people, quantitative easing for the people. In other words, to have the central bank, which does have the power to issue money, as we know, but right now all they're doing with their quantitative easing is issuing money to banks, and even then it's just in their reserve accounts. They're just swapping assets that are already in their reserve accounts for cash, which is not doing anything for the real economy. But Jeremy Corbyn would actually get it out into the real economy, which, of course, we've been talking about as a good idea for a long time. So that's one. In Iceland and Switzerland, there's a legislator who's bringing a bill for a radical reformation of the money system along the lines of the Chicago plan, which would basically be that the banks are not allowed to create money in the form of loans. And in Switzerland, there's a referendum to that effect. I think they've finally gotten the 100,000 signatures they needed. So both Iceland and Switzerland are not part of the European Monetary Union, so they have more leeway to be radical. And then Russia has been pushed too far, obviously, with all the sanctions that have been imposed on them. So they're realizing they have to have their own banking system. So there is all kinds of movement there to break away and form their own system. In Ecuador, we have new digital currency coming up because they were strapped in this straitjacket of having to use U.S. dollars. And so they only have the actual physical dollars that are printed out. So they are now issuing digital dollars right from the central bank, which you can actually open an account at. And in Kenya, we have digital money, et cetera. So you can see things percolating. You can see people getting upset. It seems to me that the purpose of terrorism is to make people afraid, very afraid, you know, so they're afraid of their neighbors. They don't get together. They don't form movements. But more and more, I think people are being jaded to the whole terrorist thing, and you do see movements forming. You see movements at the ground level forming.
Yeah. One of the things that happened during the course of this past year was the breakout of the postal banking world. And Matt, I know you've been centrally involved in helping with that. Why is that a big deal, and how's it look?
It's a big deal, and whether it happens or not, I think it's going to be really contingent on who occupies Congress next year, and to some extent after next year, and I think to some extent who occupies the White House. Although there is a huge, robust mass movement for this to happen, elected officials are going to be the ones who can spur it along most effectively, and particularly if there are some changes in the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, as well as the makeup of the Postal Board of Governors. I guess the political will or the political reality aside, the argument for postal banking has enjoyed a real resurgence in the last couple of years. Ellen's initial articles on postal banking are a big reason why in the last few years there's been a resurgence of interest. And, of course, we had a postal bank, a bank at the post office until 1967. And the idea is postal savings banks, various financial services done through the post office, including the possibility of short-term loans, as well as or payday advances. And the rationale for that is that right now you have tens of millions of Americans who are underbanked or unbanked. They don't have access to affordable financial services. And also when people, as I mentioned earlier, are in a tight financial spot, they turn to payday lenders who are predatory, and who often charge up to 350 to 400% interest on short-term loan.
Yeah.
And oftentimes there's no getting out from under that. And so people like Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, obviously the Public Banking Institute, the folks at Commonomics USA, the people in the Postal Banking Coalition, a number of other organizations have come out in support of basically a resurrection of the Postal Bank of the United States.
And I think as a positive indicator, too, from this past year, we saw a very forceful, very, very promising delay, anyway. It was really perceived as a stop of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Fast-track authority for the White House was a huge citizen expression, and it was successful for a couple of days, and then the powers that be got it through anyway. But it's still on the table, and that's going to be coming up this year, and undoubtedly that's going to be one of our big targets in 2016, because it certainly codifies the whole idea that big banks will run the future of the world from their parapets of power. But I think there is a lot to be encouraged about. One of the things that we've seen here in the U.S. and around the world is a huge growth in interest in public banking. And that, I think, says a lot about how people are beginning to understand their monetary systems in a whole new way. There's still a lot of obfuscation and mystery around money and banking and so forth. And we've been slowly taking that wall down, opening that curtain up here on this program. We'll continue to do that. But my sense is that the public banking is going to have a big year coming up. And so I think, you know, we have something to look forward in that regard. We can start to also consider how to heal and how to fix the situations where people live, maybe like basic incomes, for example, become one of the categories. And Matt, if you'd just like to throw in a quick couple of words on that, that would like to hear it.
Sure, real quick. Basic income, of course, is exactly what it sounds like, making a guaranteed minimum income available to everyone. There are a variety of ways to do that, and there are a variety of policy rationales for it, ranging from rightward to leftward. But the rationale is that available work right now in our economy is not compatible with a survivable or healthy income security for people. But then, of course, we in the public banking movement know that there's another rationale for basic income, and that has to do with the way that money is created and the feasibility of being able to create additional sources of income for the people. A kind of radical quantitative easing, if you will, that could be done with basic income. So it really is something that you should watch for to make more noise going into 2016.
Yeah, the basic hurdle is that everybody thinks it'll be hyperinflationary, which it won't. And so that's the educational point that we have to get across. It seems to me maybe we should just mention, I wouldn't want to do the wrap-up without mentioning all our little movements going on and all the how much progress they've made. For example, in Philadelphia, Santa Fe, we have three political parties that are endorsing public banking in Ireland. We have a new public banking group forming in the UK, and et cetera.
And Iceland and
Canada.
And Canada, the native tribes also. It's very encouraging. I mean, I think, if you look at the dark side of what we've just talked about, you realize that, boy, something is going to have to be done, otherwise kind of game over. But people really are resilient and creative and dedicated to getting through this. So we are really on an evolutionary moment here in monetary reform. And it's a delight to be a part of it with both of you folks.
Likewise with you.
Thank you.
All right.
It's been a really exciting year for sure. Lots of things going on the ground in lots of different places. And I think that there are many locales where things are getting very close to where we want them to be.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens next.
All right.
Thank you so much, guys. Happy New Year.
You too.
Thanks, Walt.
That was Matt Stannard and, of course, Ellen Brown, with a quick look back on some of the stories that we covered here on the show in 2015. There's a lot more to those stories, of course, and we invite you to visit our complete archives, where these and many other stories are dealt with in detail. You'll find them all at itsourmoney.podbean.com. We've been blessed with wonderful guests through this year and plan on having many more next year, and certainly hope you'll join us as we continue our examination of money and the systems that keep it going round around the world. Also, in 2016, we're hopeful to see the first of several new public interest banks around the United States and elsewhere. This is one of the most exciting prospects for economic fairness, and we hope you'll get involved in helping spread the word, as well as taking part in the creation of new American public banks. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.